Welcome to the brand new segment, The Phoenix Feature, with me, Killian McIntosh, finding Billericay's and Brentwood's hottest topics to feature each week. This week, we feature Billericay's best-selling author, Paul Connolly, as we follow his rags-to-riches story from his two best-selling books, Against All Odds and Beating the Odds, which have sold over 500,000 copies.
It's 10 years of verbal, physical, mental abuse. Strip us off in the hallways and basically stump out cigarettes on our chests. We were just playtime for them. In the dormitory I grew up in, out of eight boys, six of them have committed suicide before they were 30. So, you know, it's pretty horrendous.
This is Paul Connolly. Abandoned at birth, turned boxer, TV personality, fitness coach to celebrities, illiterate till 25, best-selling author. If you could describe your life in one word, what would it be?
Lucky.
Lucky, yeah. I would describe you as the real Rocky Balboa. I think that's a pretty accurate description for you. Yeah. So let's start off with the entrance you had to this world. It was very dramatic from the start. And sadly, you were abandoned by your mother. And 2 weeks after birth, being left for dead, found by the bins. How much do you know of this time? Has anyone told you in detail what happened? And why did your mother decide to do this?
Well, I was the last boy of seven boys. So I was the youngest. And my I had one sister. And the Irish Catholic thing is, I don't know if you know, it's against the religion to use contraception. So I understand that, you know, it was just... But obviously, she couldn't... I don't know if she had a breakdown or what. I don't really know because I didn't know my mother. All I know about my past back then is where I've read my files from being in care. You can actually go and read your files. So I know what happened, but I don't really necessarily know the circumstances surrounding it. I just thought I was the last of eight and she put me out by the bins because she had some kind of breakdown. And
obviously, you never really formed a real relationship with your mother, but is there anything you know about her at all?
Not really, no. I know that she wouldn't allow me to be adopted, and the nurse that brought me up tried to adopt me, but she wouldn't allow for that. Although I probably only met her once or twice when I was very young. I don't really know her. I don't really need to now, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't feel the need.
Did you form a relationship with the eight children? Do you have any sort of...
No, I only have contact with one of my brothers. Unfortunately, when you grow up in those circumstances, there's a lot of abuse, there's a lot of, you know, drugs, and people grow up really messed up. So when I left care, my thing was to stay away from all of those people and sort of make a fresh start and be around sane people that inspired me rather than people that were as messed up as I was, you know?
When you grew up in care... You received a lot of mental abuse from your house mother, which you described as worse than physical abuse.
Yeah.
What sort of things did she say to you, and how did that make you feel and affect your mental growth?
Well, they're great questions. I was brought up by nuns till I was seven, nearly eight. So in the convent, where once you got to eight, you had to go to St. Leonard's in Hornchurch, which was a big boys' children's home, London Borough, Tower Hamlets, like Hackney Council. So I was relatively sane for until I was seven or eight. It's when I went to the children's home in Hornchurch, where my house mother was there and my house father, where effectively this children's home was run by a paedophile ring. So this was where the abuse started. So, you know, it's not just the mental abuse stays with you forever, and you're always dealing with it. You're always going to feel less worthy than somebody else. But you have to get over it. You have to move on. She used to say to me, you're a low-life Irish scumbag, you're going to end up in prison like your brothers, or dead by the time you're in your 20s, you're not loved, because if you were loved, you obviously would be a family, you wouldn't be here, you know, obviously not normal. My introduction to her was, I wet the bed on the first night of this new children's home with 300 kids, and I was this frightened little seven-year-old. I was wet the bed, and she dragged me out in the morning, threw me in a bath, cold bleach water, with the sheets, scrubbed me till I bled. And that was to stop me weeing the bed. Obviously, that doesn't work. And, you know, that was my introduction to this lovely lady.
And how long did you have to stay with this woman?
Well, I was with them for 10 years. From eight.
Was it 10 years of that sort of thing happening day in, day out?
Yeah, it was 10 years of verbal, physical, mental abuse. But it's not, when you grow up in care, you have no sense of identity anyway. So if somebody's trying to give you a false identity, then you're very susceptible to that. So obviously that's one thing. But also, you know, you're trying to find yourself as you grow up and develop, and you develop with someone talking to you in those negative ways every day. It's very hard. I mean, her husband used to beat me daily, but that was just something you got used to. But
so it became the norm, like, this is what's going to happen today. And
the normal beatings, I mean, if you got something that was severely beaten, where I broke my, threw me down some stairs and broke my ribs and things like that, that was a bit more. But the normal slap here and slap there and, you know, kick up the backside, they used to get us out of our bedrooms and line us up in, if we messed about a night, and then they would strip us off in the hallways and basically stump out cigarettes on our chests, you know, with their friends, get drunk. We were the, you know, we were just playtime for them. So this was normal. This was actually normal. They thought this was normal behaviour. For me, it was normal because that's all I knew. But I think the problem is as well, you have no education, you have no culture, you have no sense of direction, no sense of who you are. You have to have something very deep inside you to progress as an adult after that kind of, you know, because in the dormitory I grew up in, out of eight boys, six of them have committed suicide before they were 30. So, you know, it's pretty horrendous.
A lot of children in the care you're with actually didn't make it through and resulted in suicide, like you just said. And was that something you steered away from? What kept you going mentally despite the abuse you received?
I really don't know. I just always had this. People ask me this question lots, and people say, how did you get through all that had when lots of others didn't? I just had this real optimism. I had this sense of, I just need to get through this bit and I'll be fine. I also had some decent people around me who were looking out for me. I had boxing coaches and their families who would feed me, because they used to steal the money for our food. So we were very undernourished. So you think about it, if you're not eating well, you're not performing anyway. But, you know, I had people who took pity on me, for want of a better word, and helped me. So, you know, I was lucky in a lot of respects.
You are open about being illiterate until you were 25. What sorts of education did you get growing up, if you got any at all?
I didn't go to school very much because I was severely bullied at school, and I'd come home and I'd get bullied at home. So there wasn't really anywhere for me to go. So school for me was just somewhere to survive. So if I went to school, I haven't got bullied or caned. I left school, I couldn't even tell you the alphabet, the months of the year. I couldn't read the most basic text. Absolutely no reading or writing until I hit my early 20s, when my boxing career was ended and I knew I'd have to get a career some other way. And I had to go to night school and learn to read and write. So,
did you have any paternal figures growing up, or anyone that gave you guidance?
Yeah, I think realistically it was my boxing coaches, because I'll get upset every time I talk about this, but my friend Liam, who committed suicide, we used to walk past Dagenham Boxing Club every day going to school, because we used to walk from Hornchurch to Dagenham to save our bus fares so we could eat, believe it or not. And we used to walk past this boxing club, and every day we said, oh, let's go in. And one day we got the nerve to go in, and we met the boxing coaches, these guys, and these were the first men that we met that weren't trying to beat us or bugger us. Now, this is when we were like 11, 12 years old, and they basically took us in. And I had no interest in boxing, none whatsoever, but I wanted to please them because they were the first people that ever showed an interest in me. I became quite good at boxing, but that wasn't because I was interested in boxing, it was because I was interested in pleasing them. Now, these guys turned out to be not only the boxing coaches, their wives used to come up and they saw they couldn't believe we were 11 and 12, because they thought we were about 8 or 9 because we were so small.
Yeah.
And they couldn't believe our ages. So the wives used to come up and bring us sandwiches up and feed us and things like that. They also happened to be the local gangsters, which meant that they then they actually took an interest. And the people that were abusing me they were told in no uncertain terms, this needs to stop, otherwise something's going to happen to them. So that actually stopped a lot of the abuse I was getting by the time I was about 12, 13. I stopped getting cigarettes put out on me, and I stopped the sexual.
Must have been a great relief to have someone on your side.
Yeah,
after all these years,
first time in my life, someone was standing up for me. Yeah, and it was amazing. Yeah, unfortunately, Liam didn't make it. Liam, my first book's dedicated to Liam. He jumped on a railway track at Mile End Station. Very sad.
But yeah, it must be, because that's, you know, especially as it's a best friend and.
Yeah.
Someone that really understood the pain you went through, because he went through everything that you kind of had to deal with.
And someone I considered, you know, much stronger than I was. Yeah, very sad.
it was boxing that saved your life, but almost got you thrown into jail because you were a doorman and you got unfortunately jumped and had no other option but to defend yourself. Tell me about that night and how it nearly turned your life upside down.
Absolutely. I was leading, at that time, I was leading more of a double life. I was going, being flown out to America, I was making videos with supermodels, I was training celebrities by that point. At the same time, unfortunately, everybody thought financially I was doing very well. I wasn't. That wasn't really paying very well. I was still a doorman. I was a doorman for 15 years. And this one night, I let these five guys in the club against my better nature because one of the doormen knew them. And you just knew, I just knew they were trouble. And they started, the minute they walked in the club, they were throwing live cigarette butts off the balcony to try and aim into girls' cleavages. And the panic buttons were going off. And the other doorman who knew them had disappeared because he knew they were trouble and he didn't want to be involved. So I knew effectively I was on my own. It was a very packed club. So I basically said to them, look, you're out, you've got to go. And I knew that my major concern was to get them outside the door, because if it had kicked off in the club, so many other people would have got hurt. They did walk out with me, but I knew they were going to attack me the minute I walked out the door. And they did. And without getting into too much detail, I was attacked by five men. And there is no such thing as excessive force when you're fighting for your life.
No, yeah.
And I hurt two of them quite badly. And I was arrested on GBH and GBH with intent, which is a Section 18 and Section 20, which is a minimum of 5 years in prison. And I had a year and a half to wait to go to Crown Court. I was looking at prison sentences that hanging over me for a long time. Went to Basham Crown Court, 5 days in court, and the jury were only out for an hour, and they came back with self-defence, reasonable force. And, you know, it was a pivotal turning point for me, because all my life, you know, when I'm growing up, these people you're saying, you're going to prison, you're evil and all of that. So I'm sitting there waiting for a jury to come back going, guess what, they were right. You know, again, being very lucky, having really good people around me who were helping me, good friends and people who believed in me. And that's the thing, yeah. You know, if you don't believe in yourself growing up, or, you know, I wasn't even growing up then, I was a man then. If you don't believe in yourself, it does help to have people around you who believe in you.
Yeah.
You know? It was one of those pivotal turning points in your life where that sliding door moment, that not guilty, only had to be a guilty, and my life would have been very different than it is today. Because obviously, you know,
Everything would have changed.
Oh, everything, yeah.
It would have been a completely different life. Being tipped for big things as a boxer, you had a 70-foot fall through a glass roof and severed your hand and arm. What happened? How did that all...
I cut my hand in half.
You can see the scars.
Yeah, severed my arm almost off. I just signed contracts pro fight. I had my first pro fight that weekend, believe it or not. And I fell off a roof ladder on a roof, a job that should have been scaffolded. I was just making some money, helping a friend out. And there was a glass door at the bottom, which I went through, and it severed my arm almost off and my hand in half. I bled to death. They managed to obviously revive me through blood transfusions, and they saved my life. I was sitting in like a pool of blood, with like warm blood. It was like in a bath, and it was my blood, you know. And you just think, oh God, I'm not going to get out of this one. This is it for me. But lucky enough, I was only in my early 20s,
yeah.
And I was very fit, and that's how I survived, because they wanted to amputate my hand at the time, and I wouldn't allow them to. They said, so we just need to take it off. And as you can see, I can use it. It's not a problem.
Yeah.
And that was an awful time again. And then obviously I was illiterate then. So I had no reading or writing. I had no, even when I did get over it, they said to me, you need to study for a sedentary job. You'll never do anything physical. So I was the first personal trainer in the city in 86. I've been a personal trainer for 30 years. So they were wrong now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what I've got here, that if it hadn't been for your injury, you could have gone further in boxing. Like you had said, you had your first pro fight. It must have been so devastating for you at the time that...
It was,
you
yeah.
were like... You always get so close to something and then something pulls you back. Yeah. It must be so frustrating.
It isn't, it isn't. Because to be fair, I was a middleweight at the time. It was a time Nigel Benn and all the... I don't know if you know your boxing, but it was a time where there was a really strong middleweight divisions in this country and all around the world. I wouldn't necessarily have made the best... Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily have gone all the way. There's no way of knowing that.
Yeah.
But having said that, what I've done now is, obviously, I had 2 years in rehabbing my own body. I got really into the body. I studied, I did my first gym instructor qualification. I learned to read and write, obviously, which was the third thing I had to do. And now, you know, what I do now is far more rewarding. I mean, I'm stopping people, I'm getting people out of pain every day, you know, and I've had 9 of my children's scoliosis operations cancelled, out of back braces, they're out of pain. You know, this is really rewarding stuff, you know, this is, and, you know, I'm 53 now, so I would have been maybe a bit punch drunk if I'd have had a boxing career. I don't know, you can never know, but to be fair, I think that there was a reason I fell off that roof. I know it sounds crazy.
Going off of that, with your scoliosis success, there is a success story on one of your websites from Jenna. And Jenna says, Paul has literally worked a miracle and done in 6 weeks what doctors couldn't do in 10 years. He saved me from a life-altering operation. And for the first time in years, I'm not worried. I mean, that's a massive sense of achievement for yourself. And, you know, for a life that could have gone in so many different directions, and for you to now be helping people change their lives for the better, and giving others a better quality of life, does that make you feel proud? And
yeah, it's amazing. I mean, Jenna is now a personal trainer herself. She now runs her own personal training business. And, you know, it's scoliosis, lumbosis, all of those back conditions are life-changing. They're devastating. The NHS treat people the same way as they have in the last 100 years. The same way 100 years ago, they treat the same way, and it doesn't deal with the problem. It just makes the back look better. I've reconditioned the back. I've rebalanced the back. I also massage and get all the angry tissues out. And so basically, the back works together. Our bodies can right themselves if we do the right things. And I just, you know, being a specialist conditioning coach and an injury rehab and sports massage, it's just one of those things which just meant for me to do. And, you know, I have kids come to me in back braces, in pain, with operations for rods, booked in for rods to be put in their back. You get them out of the back braces, you get them out of pain, you get their operations cancelled, and, you know, the parents are, you know, it's just, there's nothing better than to, you know, to save someone from that kind of pain and agony. And those operations don't actually help in the long run. The body needs to help itself.
So you're 25 and illiterate. What steps did you take and what did you use to learn reading and writing from scratch? I'm interested to know how an adult would take them steps that the majority of us, when we're like 2-3 years old, already have.
I had to go to night school. I had to go back to school, and literally it took me 3 years. And without being rude, I was in with people that are not particularly bright, you know, so I had to swallow my pride. And people that have learning difficulties, people that have, you know, more problems than I have, you know, it's slightly patronising, but at the same time, I can understand where these people were coming from, because that's what they're used to dealing with.
Were you scared at all when writing a book because of the pressure from all the people you've told your life stories to and the expectation from those who originally encouraged you? Because I know there was a lot of people you've told stories to and they've said, you have to write these books, and now you've got this pressure. Yeah.
Well, I felt a compulsion to write the book. Yes, because people said to me, you should put this down and write a book. But also because, I don't know if you're aware, I actually stalked my paedophiles and was going to kill them. And I was also going to kill myself at the same time afterwards. I couldn't do it before. And for some reason, yet again, I've always had some sort of thing that stopped me. I was in the pub, and this woman just caught my eye, and she was crying, and she said, please don't do it. I don't know who this woman was.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I didn't. I was so determined to do it.
Essentially, that woman saved you.
Yeah, yeah. And God knows where she come from, and it was the strangest thing. You know when someone catches your eye, she'd seen me pull a gun out, and she'd seen me cock it, took the safety off, and I could easily get hold of a gun because I was hanging around naughty people. I was a doorman for 15 years, and I was very angry and I was very determined. So how the hell I never did it, I don't know. How the hell I never did it myself, I don't know. I just don't know. It's just every time these things tend to happen to me, somebody comes from somewhere to help me, and people go, oh, yeah. I know this is where people go, oh, crazy person, but people go, oh, you know, it's guardian angel, someone looking after you. A long time after that, you know, so it took a long time for me to think, I've got to do something positive. I've got to tell the story for all the people that were abused. I mean, and people that are not here. I mean, and it's and if you talk to people who've had, quote, a normal upbringing, they don't believe that this is possible. They really don't believe this can go on, you know, and it goes on all the time. It goes on today.
The first book, which is the bestseller, Against All Odds, along with Beating the Odds, which is also a bestseller, covers your earlier years of your life and then Beating the Odds, the second half.
Beating the Odds is basically what's happened since I wrote the bestseller. It's it's me giving speeches in the House of Lords, public speaking, helping charities like Beanstalk, raising lots of money. I mean, I now find myself standing in front of crowds of people I've never believed I could even have met. I did one recently with Boris Johnson, Princess Laurentine of Holland, Toby Young, Lord Archer, and I was the keynote speaker. They've all come to see me. And that just is freaky, you know, because I'm standing there and they're bigging me up and then I'm the keynote speaker and Boris Johnson gets up and everyone's laughing and I get up and everyone's crying. You know? And then Lord Archer gets up and says, right, now who's the richest person on your table? We're going to raise money for this charity. Now, Beanstalk is a literacy charity for kids. So it goes into schools and picks up the slack for kids like me who can't read and write. So this particular night, we raised almost 200 grand. And there was one picture of Margaret Thatcher before she died. It was a sketch. And this guy got up to 10 grand, 20 grand, 30 grand, 40 grand. And we're like sitting there with our mouths open. This guy paid 100 grand for a pencil drawing of Margaret Thatcher. And then he said That's afterwards amazing. To the Standard, this was on the back of Paul Connolly's speech because, you know, he really made an impression on me. So, you know, the fact that you can do that and raise this kind of money. And, you know, I did a speech in the House of Lords for the same charity. And, you know, I worked with kids from locally with, you know, the learning difficulties and kids like me who grew up similar to me. So now it's about giving back. Now it's about, you know, getting the best for my family. It's about helping people. It sounds a bit sanctimonious, but we all get far more from helping people than, you know, the people we're helping get. The sense of achievement and well-being and all of those things when you actually help someone is amazing. So for me, it's like, I'm lucky, I'm very lucky, and I want to help other people now.
When you found out you were a best-selling author, how did that make you feel? Did you ever think before you wrote these books that that could be a possible
thing? No, absolutely not. The whole thing to write Against All Odds was for me to get a story out there and get people aware of what really goes on. And it was really, really lucky because W.H. Smith picked the book up and it sold about 20,000 copies. It was doing reasonably well, but it wasn't going crazy. And all of a sudden, we had the birth of the Kindle and the tablet, and it went viral. It went viral over a couple of weeks. It sold 500,000 copies. So it outsold Girl with Dragon Tattoo, outsold all the top Hollywood movies. It was like, it went absolutely crazy. This book really touches a note, you know, in people's hearts. The reviews went crazy. And I got a phone call over the Christmas period where my publishers were closed, and it was John Blake, the boss of the publishing house, because it's John Blake's publisher. Hello, old chap. He said, I just wanted to let you know and congratulate you on your book becoming a bestseller. Now, I'm thinking one of my mates is messing about. So I've gone, you know, I've gone F off and put the phone
down. Oh, no.
He's called back and he goes, excuse me, old chap, I am your publisher and I'd really rather you didn't speak to me like that. You actually have. And then so we put the laptop on and he's like, oh, my God, it's so, like, you know, it's gone up to nearly 500,000 copies in the literally over a weekend.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it just went absolutely crazy. And, you know, and I get letters and emails and phone calls from people all the time. You know, you've really helped me. This is similar to my childhood. I can really, really resonates with me. And lots of children I grew up with contacted me as well as adults.
Finally, you have been through a lot in your life. You've had every obstacle thrown in your way possible. Now, what advice would you give to people coming out of school, college, university, who are struggling to find a job and worried about their own future in this uncertain world we live in? Obviously, I think the best person to hear advice from would be you, where you've literally started from nothing.
Blimey. Okay, so for me, I can only speak from my experience. I've always gone with my gut instinct, okay, and intuition you know, when it comes to people, surround yourself with people that inspire you. Don't surround yourself with negative people. Because you literally have to, you know, there's no point in, you know, as a fighter, you always want to fight the best fighter, not somebody who's not going to challenge you. We always need to push ourselves, take ourselves out of our comfort zones. But see, we've got all got a gut feeling inside us. We've all got an intuition. We've all got instinct. And we tend not to use it. And it actually is there for a reason. It's there for us to guide us through our lives. Now, our gut feeling, our intuition, that's as important as an education. That's as important. We've all got gifts. We've all got skills. We all just need to understand what they are and to make the best of them. Now, I wasn't particularly well educated, but what I do is very hands-on. It's very instinctive. It's very, you know, it's just in me. You know, I used to get the kids out of the bedrooms and work them out when we were 5 and 6 in the dormitories. I don't know what I was doing, but it was in me. You have to know what's in you, and you have to know where you're going, you know. And I just think at the end of the day, rely on your gut. Rely on, you know, where we've all got our natural paths laid out, and you just need to just go with it. And people that are inspirational to you, mentors, people like that, they're really, really important. And look for people like that. And you know, people like that have been through hard times, and people like that who are educated, people like that who can help you. They're going to want to help you. We all want to mentor. We all want to bring people up. We all want to inspire. And yeah, it's all about, we're here once, aren't we? So
you got to give it your best shot.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, mate.
Thank you for listening to this amazing story. And if you want to hear the full interview again, just go to www.phoenixfm.com, and Paul's best-selling book can be purchased at amazon.co.uk. Join us next week for more Phoenix Feature.